Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. People today are divided. We are filled with outrage. We fight about morality and politics at the polls, on social media, and at the dinner table. These clashes destroy friendships and threaten our democracy. Those are the opening sentences of our guest this hour's new book, Outraged: Why We Fight About Morality and Politics and How to Find Common Ground. Every word in those opening sentences is true. But it is his insight into why we react to each other this way, an insight based on science, and his promise that we have more in common than we think that intrigued us, and that is why we invited Kurt Gray to join us for the hour. Dr. Gray is a social psychologist and researcher who studies our deepest held beliefs and how to bridge moral divides, and he does so as a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UNC Chapel Hill, where he directs the Deepest Beliefs Lab and the Center for the Science of Moral Understanding. Dr. Thank you for being with us. Good morning, Dr. Gray.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So many of today, we have a lot of ground to cover here in this book, but many of today's most contested arguments, our deepest disagreements about politics, are really based in morality. They are moral arguments, and it seems that people on the left have one set of moral values while people on the right have their own, and never the twain shall meet. And we're going to talk about that as we go through the hour. But let me start with a question about the organization that you direct, the Center for the Science of Moral Understanding. I think people would be surprised that there is a science behind what we consider moral or immoral. And in fact, your website for that organization says, quote, "We are creating a new science of moral understanding." I would think that most people think that morality is based in religion. It's not.
Well, I think many people base their own moral convictions in religion. But what the center and what the science is really about is studying how people who are ultimately good people can disagree about the same topic, right? Half of America is divided on immigration, on abortion, on taxes. And so what in their minds makes us disagree, even though we ultimately have the same brains, right? We have the same kind of cognitive stuff in our head, and yet we disagree. And so that's what the center's about, why we disagree, and ultimately how to overcome that disagreement and find some common ground so that we can have better conversations and move forward.
But there have always been differences of opinion, always differences between individual, different points of view. There have always been people who are conservative versus being liberal, and they don't see the world the same way. They never have. But until recently, we have always found ways to compromise, to find a middle ground that we can agree to exist in together. But today that seems to be impossible. And in fact, compromise has become a dirty word. And this, I'm right, you're wrong, and if we follow your path, we're going to hell in a handbasket, is tearing us apart. So we also seem to be living in a time of victimhood, with some people fighting over who is the real victim by what we believe. Is there some scientific theory then to how we got to this place?
Well, first I want to say that finding common ground is not impossible, even if it's more challenging. And there are lots of folks today who manage to find common ground, who agree to disagree. Even some spouses disagree about politics and still manage to live together in the same roof. But I think it has gotten more contentious. But I think that the kind of increased animosity that we're feeling, I think it really, you know, focuses on elites. So the government, that's contentious. The book is not about, you know, why the government is so contentious right now, why lawmakers disagree. It's how everyday people can make sense of each other, and we can come to more common ground in our relationships, in the workplace, in our families. And so I think it is possible, even if there's lots of reasons why it's more contentious today. Happy to talk about those if you'd like.
Yeah, well, and we will. I know that a lot of this of your theory is about finding ways to listen to each other and understand each other, because understanding, and I found this to be true, in conversations on this program, where you invite somebody on that you completely disagree with, and you have an intelligent conversation with them, and you may end up not agreeing with them, but you understand how they got to where they are, and that diffuses a lot of the tension in the room. But we're seeing an unwillingness on the part, at least in politics, of people to do that. I mean, if you are a Republican in Washington and you don't toe the line with Donald Trump, you're a rhino. If you're a Democrat in Washington and you cross the aisle and vote on something that is fundamentally considered to be a Republican issue, you are a traitor. Those characterizations are the results of actions, but do they also impede attempts at listening to each other and coming to understand each other?
I think we can find understanding, even if the kind of political elites on the Hill are more divided than others. So Congress is undoubtedly gridlocked, right? They're set in their positions. It's a contentious political moment. But I still think that we can come to some kind of understanding, the kind of understanding you mentioned, where we can listen and make sense of where people are coming from, even if we disagree. And again, this is not me being an apologist for Elon Musk, for instance. It's about how people can reconnect with their uncles or cousins or kids who might disagree with them on politics. And there's science-backed ways to make sense of why we're disagreeing and how to bridge those divides better, reestablish our relationships, and have a stronger community at the local level.
But it's become very difficult to do that. For politicians, it's extremely difficult because this deep divide, compromise, has become a political career-ending move for a lot of politicians. And for people at the dinner table, your aunts and uncles and cousins who come to Thanksgiving, we no longer, if they don't have your point of view politically, they're not just the uncle who disagrees with you. They have the potential for being our evil enemy. We've suddenly put labels on people. We don't see the other side as honorable opposition, but as evil. How do you get beyond that? Why did we get here? What's the science behind that?
Well, I think the science behind how we've gotten more contentious in our nation is fairly clear. There's lots of things at the kind of structural level, right? So, politicians, they don't live on the Hill anymore. They come back to their district. There's primaries, there's social media bubbles, there's residential segregation, where you probably only live next to someone who agrees exactly with you. But again, I don't think this is destiny, even if we're divided now. And I know lots of people, and I know lots of organizations that have amazing successes having conversations with people. Once we get over the insight that you really aptly brought up, that we sometimes think that understanding is betrayal, but it's not, right? And pragmatically, if we want to move the goals of the country forward, we need to understand where people are coming from, right? And not just demonize them, if only pragmatically.
Because this lack of understanding and this quickness to demonize the other side for what they believe and what you think is wrong and evil has led to outrage, to gridlock. We were angry before gridlock. Gridlock has led to outrage because nothing gets done. And yet you say that the vast majority of people have a basic moral sense, and it is the same no matter who you vote for. That might be surprising to a lot of listeners. What does that basic moral sense consist of?
You touched on it just a little bit when you mentioned the word victimhood, but the basic moral sense is really about perceptions of harm, right? It can seem like liberals and conservatives have fundamentally different values, but this isn't true. If you look at the data, we can all respect or understand a set of values, but really what we all care about are protecting our family and ourselves and our country from harm. All of our moral judgments are ultimately grounded in perceptions of harm and the desire to protect ourselves. And this is because if you look way back in evolution, right, we've always been concerned about harm and protecting ourselves, right? And we still have that idea today where we're still worried about threats. We're fearful of harms. And so our moral sense is fundamentally grounded in that deep concern.
So our ancestors had legitimate fears about being harmed by wild animals or other tribes coming into their camps, etc. We've progressed well beyond that. The harms that we fear today are physical, yes, because there is this sometimes illogical fear of crime, which does not exist to the extent that some people would have us believe. But there's also the fear of psychological harm and societal harm. If we follow your path, society is going to be damaged. Why do we fear societal harm?
Well, because ultimately, as human beings, we all depend on society to flourish, to thrive. Our children, and I want to say that, you know, all of our moral convictions are really grounded in concerns about the vulnerable, especially children, right? Think of the children as a rallying cry for almost every moral, you know, concern. And so we worry about the degradation of society, the downfall of our social norms, because without it, it's anarchy, it's chaos, right? We need society and a functioning community to thrive. And so when that seems to be kind of decaying, we get really upset.
But again, we've had these fears forever. They've been in humankind forever, in every society, in every country, in every community around the country. I'm sure that when FDR was president, there were people on the conservative side who were appalled by some of the things that he was doing when he was putting in the building blocks of the New Deal. And those things are being dismantled now by the other side as Donald Trump takes over. And the left is appalled by what he's doing. And the left at the moment feels, and perhaps with some justification, I don't know, that Donald Trump is harming the nation. I'm sure that they felt that FDR was harming the nation. Is this new? And if it's not new, these feelings of total destruction coming our way at any moment, why does it seem so much more intense today?
It's not new. You're absolutely right. Ancient Romans were worried about, you know, the harmful effects of government. Ancient Romans worried about this generation, right, the harm caused by the current political climate. But I think it's amplified today because our media is so amplified, right? In the past, you might have heard news trickle through as messengers came or read it in the newspaper. But today, social media turbocharges our feelings of threat, right? And we've got research on this. You look on social media, you see a threat, this terrible thing's happening. You see a virality metric, right, which tells you thousands of people are worried about this. And our social minds nudge us to think that we should worry about that too. We're a herd species, right? And so we think everyone's worried about this moral panic, right? And we're screaming, we're yelling, we're outraged because of that moral panic. So I think it's not just social media or cable news, but it helps, right, to drive this kind of outrage. And so we're trapped in these kind of competing camps of what visions of reality and what's really harmful. Again, that's what's at stake, right? We all think that what the other side's trying to do, as you say, is harmful, and they think that of us. And so common ground really requires us understanding that the other side is not trying to destroy America, but trying to protect what they see as important.
Yeah, it's one thing to see the other side as doing something you disagree with and you would do it differently. And perhaps because you would do it differently, you think that they are wrong and harmful. It is another thing, I think, to question the motivation of the people, that they're not doing it to make the country better. They're doing it because they want to destroy the country. And I want to explore that when we come back from the break, this destruction narrative. Our guest, Dr. Kirk Gray, Outraged, We Fight, Why We Fight About Morality and Politics and How to Find Common Ground is his latest book. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Kurt Gray is our guest professor of psychology and neuroscience and director of the Deepest Beliefs Lab and Center for the Science of Moral Understanding at UNC Chapel Hill. He's written about where we are today in our politics and our relationships with each other in a book called Outraged, Why We Fight About Morality and the Politics and How to Find Common Ground. I wanted to talk about this destruction narrative, because it's not just that we think sometimes that the other side is doing things that are harmful and we all have fear of being harmed, which is the root of all of this, but it's that we question their motivation. We think that they're not only harming the country, they're doing it deliberately. They want to harm the country, and that's what scares us even more. In your book, you had this one sentence: the destruction narrative is alluring, but most people are not motivated to destroy. Why are you so certain of that?
I want to say that there's maybe 1% of the population that's psychopaths, so let's put them aside, right? There are some people out there who are cold and callous, but 99% of people are not. So if you think of yourself and your friends, right, people who vote the same way, you know that you vote to protect the country, protect your interests, right, protect your family. And it turns out that the other side does too. So there's lots of data, there's lots of studies that show that all of us are mostly motivated by protecting ourselves, by in-group love, and not by out-group hate for the most part, right? I think the problem is that every time you vote on an issue, there are trade-offs, right? There are harms on both sides. And so when you vote to protect something, let's say with abortion or immigration, right, there's inevitable harms that people regret on the other side, but don't intend. The problem is that we think the other side intends those harms. So if you're pro-life, you think, right, that you're trying to protect fetuses, and pro-choice folks think that you're trying to hurt women. But that's not the case, typically. And so we need to, I think, get out of this destruction narrative and into what I call the protection narrative in our minds, which is really why people do what they do at the polls, right, and on social media.
Another good example, it's happening right now in Washington, as Donald Trump and Elon Musk are trying to root out government fraud, waste, and abuse. That's what they say, but what they're doing and the way they're doing it makes people on the left think, no, they're just wrecking everything. They're taking a machete to the government, they're firing people wholesale, and then rehiring them because they, oh, we made a mistake, we need those people, etc. They're trying to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education, and they're saying that they want to turn education back to the states, but the states already control education. The real the real purpose of the Department of Education is to provide funding for certain key programs, including student loans. At the state level, we have the Republican legislature putting out vouchers for students to be able to take that money and go to any school of their choice, as opposed to public schools, which on the face of it sounds like a great idea. It's freedom. On the other hand, the Democrats would say, well, they're taking, not really giving you choice, they're giving money to rich people who don't need it, because the money that they're giving you in these vouchers is not enough to pay the full freight of a private school education. So the poorest of the poor will still be left behind in schools that will be languishing because they no longer have enough money to operate. And there are people on the left who say Donald Trump is destroying our democracy. You say that this destruction narrative is destructive in and of itself. But what if
That's
they're
right?
What if they're right?
Again, I think I can't speak to the inner workings of the minds of Trump or Elon, right, for why they're doing what they're doing and the cuts. I mean, as a university professor, I was certainly saddened when they slashed NIH indirects, right, which is really going to hurt research. And I perceive real harm, you know, to my colleagues, to my students, and to the nation, to be honest, in cutting the kind of competitive advantage in science that America has always had. And as a Canadian, right, I'm proud to come to America to be part of this entire scientific enterprise. At the same time, I do think that the average person who's an independent or who's a Republican and votes that way is not trying to destroy America, right? What they're trying to do is save money in the government so they can better afford eggs, gas, right? I don't think they are motivated to destroy. And I do think that people's perceptions of the world with kind of media and social media can sometimes be disconnected from the facts. But our minds work not based on facts, but on stories and the stories told in the media. So I think some blame lies at elites who are telling certain narratives that I don't think are necessarily true. But I don't think everyday people are thinking, let's destroy science, let's destroy the country. They're thinking, let's protect America from waste. Let's, be great again, right? That phrase taps onto this protection ideal, even if the leaders in the country might not always be as sincere.
But you're a scientist, and there is a bias against science, it seems, in this country. And we have a Secretary of Health, the Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy, who questions science and scientists and scientific process. And that feeds into these fears on the part of many on the right about science not being our friend, shouldn't get vaccinated, it's harmful despite what the scientists tell you, don't believe the elites. How do you respond to that? This is nonsense.
I do think that the kind of anti-science bent that's running through, I think, some folks and the current administration is puzzling and a problem, I think, for the country, like measles outbreaks, right? Science explores how you can cure cancer, how you can get better. But I don't think that demonizing the people who vote for those policies is the answer ahead, right? I think what we need to do is understand where they're coming from, get to that underlying motivation, make sense of who and what they're trying to protect and their assumptions about the world, and then meet people where they're at if we want any chance of kind of moving ahead with a kind of more scientific agenda, with policies that are, I think, more beneficial to the country. You can't just say, well, they're crazy, or like those stories are wrong. It's not going to help, right? It's not going to help. You scream at someone you see with a red hat and you mock them or feel contempt. They're not going to come along, right? So if you want to convince folks that we need to move ahead, you want to persuade them that your side's the right side, you can't do that with yelling at them or insulting them. You need to understand where their mind's at and then meet them where they're at to move ahead.
People are frustrated and unhappy in America today for a myriad reasons, and everybody experiences the world individually. There's no one experience of the world in which we live, and yet, by all metrics, at least in this country today, we live at the safest, best time in the history of the human race. And yet we are angry and fearful. And you say that we still cannot shake our feelings of fear, like when we scroll through social media. And you said you believe social media is mostly bad for us because it amplifies outrage. Algorithms are built to get us angry. So I have to ask, in the absence of social media, if politicians dialed it back, if Fox News and other peddlers of mis and disinformation geared toward inciting rage were to disappear, would much of our fear with what's going on around us disappear with it?
I think our fear would always be here, right? I think we are hardwired to fear threats, to detect harms. Imagine your kids are playing outside on the front lawn, you live in a suburb, and you see a white panel van drive slowly up the street and drive slowly back. Your first thought isn't that it's a lost locksmith, right? It's that there is a kidnapper looking to pick out your kid. And so I think no matter the situation, no matter how objectively safe we are, we always fear some kind of threats. But I do think that social media and cable news turbocharges our fears, right? Really preys on those fears and amplifies them. So I think if social media disappeared, and I want to say there are good social media platforms, those are not the platforms most of us are on, but if those bad platforms disappeared and people watched less cable news, I do think that we would be less outraged and more willing to understand where others are coming from and have those conversations, right? Because we don't approach conversations then with a mindset of destruction. But I do think we'll always be worried about fears.
So we've been hardwired to be fearful of things that could harm us. And that's a self-protection mechanism. If you're in the middle of the Arizona desert and you come across a rattlesnake, you back away because it could bite you and kill you. You take yourself away from situations and individuals and creatures that could harm you. It all makes perfect sense. But some of the anger and the fear that we feel today is generated by these social media platforms and by cable news. And yet every day we go back for more. Why?
Some of us, I try not to go onto X ever anymore because I know how the algorithms work. I mean, I think we go back for more for the same reasons that we make our moral judgments, right? We're afraid. And so we're afraid that if we don't go on these platforms, we'll miss some important threat and we'll miss the chance to stop that threat. And the way we stop that threat is by getting outraged, right? This used to be when we lived in small groups, small tribes, right? There was a threat, we'd band together, we'd get our pitchforks, our torches, and we'd expel that threat, right? We'd exile that bad person, you know, into the forest, into the wilderness, and then we could live safely. We still have that mentality, but society's so different, right? There's no more pitchforks and expelling people in a kind of actual real world sense. Instead, we do that on social media. We try to cancel people, we yell at them, but it doesn't do the job that we think it does, right? It just gets them angry and gets the other side angry. And so it's not very functional, but it still feels right to most people because of how our minds work. We want to detect threats and we want to get outraged at them.
So these people that we disagree with, we we have a tendency now to demonize them, call them monsters, or question their motivation for what they're trying to do and what they say. And something else has entered into the equation, and that is we look at them now as less intelligent and less moral than ourselves. And I would think that that opinion makes us less able to make sound judgments about both the people that we disagree with and the things that they are putting forth. Why do we have the impression that the other side is stupid?
Well, if you think about your own moral beliefs, right, you think that they are objectively true. Of course, right, the fact that America disagrees about 50-50 about issues means that, right, there's clearly room for disagreement. But if you think you know an objective fact, right, 2 + 2 = 4, and you think of morality like that, and then you see the other side as saying, well, it's different, 2 + 2 = 5 or 6, then you think that either, look, they're stupid, they're really bad at math, or they're somehow evil and just they know the answer's 4 and they're telling me it's 5 or 6. And so that's when we perceive the other side, we perceive them as being either willfully ignorant, that's the evil part, or stupid.
Well, I have to ask, isn't that the case? I mean, we have been living an upside down world now for 10 years where the sky is not blue unless I say it's blue. It could just as well be green. And you've written scientifically about an experiment that people conducted where they presented liberals and conservatives with the same math problem. It was a basic math problem, but it was a word problem. And as someone challenged in school by word problem, I could do the math, but the words got in the way on the word problem. It gets in the way. You talk about this. They gave people a math problem to figure out in which there was a definitive answer, but it was answered differently by Republicans and Democrats because the wording of the question had to deal with the safety that surrounds concealed carry permits.
Yeah, I love this study. And it shows that both folks on the left and the right prefer, you know, the facts that support them and will fudge the math that they do and how they make sense of the world rationally to support their political convictions, right? So presenting progressives and conservatives with this problem, right? Do concealed guns help make us safer? And for Republicans, they got the answer that no, it turns out that handguns do not make us safer when they're concealed. And for Democrats, it was the opposite. Yes, concealed permits make people safer. And there was some complicated math that you had to do to kind of like show that this was the case. Not that complicated. If you finished high school, you should be able to do it. And it turns out that when The problem supported the other side. People fudged the numbers. They fudged their kind of cognition and their reasoning to make the answer support themselves regardless, right? And I think that's really interesting. So people can do the math, but as soon as it supports the other side, you're like, nope, I'm just going to give up on my reasoning and just say that I was right all along.
And we're seeing that on the macro level. It's been happening now in both iterations of the Trump administration. From the very first day when Sean Spicer stepped out to the newsroom at the White House and said the inauguration, the first inauguration, had the biggest crowd in presidential history. Clearly not true, but he was manipulating the math to fit the narrative. So in that situation, when both sides do it to a certain degree, How can you find middle ground? Because the truth is in the numbers.
Well, here's the thing about our minds, and that when it comes to politics, it's not really about the numbers, right? People's convictions, our deepest beliefs, are not based on statistics.
But
they are based
to believe the truth. Where are we?
Well, I agree. As a scientist, right, facts are incredibly important. I deal with statistics, but if I come to you and you have a deep belief on immigration or abortion, and I give you some statistic, some true statistic that suggests that, you know, your moral view might be modified, might not be as right as you think, you'll just say, well, that's not a real stat, right? Your moral conviction will stand no matter how many facts I throw at you. And so to think that you can win an argument when it comes to morality, right, that you can find common ground with the other side by throwing statistics at the other side, it's not gonna work.
I mean, I don't think that I'm any smarter than anybody listening or anybody out there. In fact, I might be a lot stupider than a lot of people listening. But I have had conversations on the air with people whom I absolutely disagree. And by the end of the conversation, not only do I understand their point of view, they have convinced me that they are right. So why can't we reach that in our politics?
I think we can, but I think it's in these conversations that you're talking about, right? If you sit down with someone else who's well-meaning, right, and you're both trying to understand, you can come to more common ground. So in the book, I talk about Daryl Davis. He's a black man. He's a blues musician. He committed his life to having civil, respectful conversations with KKK members. Right? These are people that many others, rightly so, think are kind of beyond the pale, right? Not deserving a conversation. And yet, by sitting down with them and having a conversation, he convinces them to hang up their robes because he understands their feelings of threats. Right.
Kirk Gray is our guest. His book is called Outraged, Why We Fight About Morality in Politics and How to Find Common Ground. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Kurt Gray is our guest, professor of psychology and neuroscience, director of the Deepest Beliefs Lab and Center for the Science of Moral Understanding at UNC Chapel Hill. His latest book is called Outraged, Why We Fight About Morality and Politics and How to Find Common Ground. You were talking just before the break about a black musician who had conversations with members of the KKK and convinced them to take off their robes and be legitimate human beings. Should we have questions with people who disagree with us? And in most cases, in that case, it obviously helped, but in most cases, does it?
Well, I think the example of Daryl Davis is such a powerful one because when people are thinking, should I talk to this person who votes differently? You know, they're my uncle, they're my cousin, I've known them for a long time, but they vote for someone I disagree with. I don't know, can I ever change them? It's probably not worth it, right? I feel somehow evil even just engaging them in conversation. But Daryl Davis is someone, right, is a black man, engages in a conversation with folks who are not only beyond the pale, many of us think, when it comes to morality, but kind of actively saw him, right, as an African-American man, as someone who's evil or violent. But by taking the first step and sitting down and trying to understand where these folks are coming from, not only did he get a sense that they were human beings, but they got a sense that he was a human being as well, and they hung up their robes. So if you want to have a chance of finding common ground with someone, but really getting someone else to find common ground with you, then you need to be able to sit down and try to understand where they're coming from.
And you can't find common ground if you think of the other person as a monster. And you say that half of America is not trying to destroy you or your values. They just want things to work. They want their families to thrive, and they want milk to be affordable. I think maybe the better example now would be eggs. But that was written before the egg crisis. We all live in the same country. We all live in the same world. We all watch the same television programs and movies, and we hear the same conversations. Why do we see things so differently? We have these common values, that the one I just pointed out. So why do we see two very different ways to get to that end?
Well, I'm not sure we listen to the same things anymore, right? It used to be ABC, NBC, CBS, right? You sit down, you watch one anchor, right? But today you have cable news, you've got social media, right? You probably live with neighbors who agree with you. The conversations you have reinforce that you should vote for, you know, red or blue. Half of America, you know, maybe goes to church on Sundays, the other half doesn't. Right. I do think that we're kind of bathing each of us in like separate narratives about what's harmful, right? About the threats that we need to worry about. And I think because of this kind of from childhood, right? Our parents are telling us, what are the threats that we face? Are the threats kind of socialism, right? Or are the threats rampant inequality? And because we're kind of growing up with that, by the time we get to voting age, right, we see such different worldviews about what's harmful.
There's an article, and I only skimmed it this morning, so I don't know enough to talk about it intelligently, but there's an article in the New York Times this morning about scientists studying about whether they're studying the argument about nature versus nurture. And they're discovering that our genes are influenced by our surroundings and the people around us, and vice versa. So how much of our viewpoint, our morality, is grounded in what we grew up understanding from our parents? Because some people rebel against that morality and take another path entirely. How much of it is simply hardwired into us? We were born conservative. We were born liberal, to take those viewpoints.
There is some argument that, you know, political ideology is somewhat inborn, like someone innate, someone in brain structures. But I think that evidence is so small. And I think for the most part, what's really inborn is this concern about threat. Are these worries about harms? And then what our upbringing, what nurture gives us, is the specific source of those harms. So if you grow up in a family that's evangelical and you learn that there's an immortal soul that can be harmed by sin, you're going to have a very different sense of how to protect yourself in the world than someone who grows up in a progressive secular family that doesn't believe in a soul. You might have different positions on gay marriage. You might have different positions on transgender rights. And so all these things come from our parents, and you can rebel, but for the most part, people vote in the same way that their parents did, right? Because of their upbringing and because of the kind of environment that they're surrounded in, the land, right, the cities that we grow up in, they give us a different sense of the threats we need to worry about.
Where does religion come into play in all of this? Because you can be a very moral person and live a very moral life and be an atheist, and you can be amoral or immoral in your approach to the world and be a Christian or a Muslim or any other religion that you want to name. Where does religion fall into this? What role does it play?
Well, religion, I think, you know, is a powerful source of meaning for many folks. And I have some work on this, and many people who are religious especially believe that it's essential to be moral. And I think for the most part, religion does encourage people to kind of think often about, is this the right thing to do? Is this consistent with the teachings of Jesus, right? But it's not, It's not a magic thing that makes people good. As you say, you can have, people justify mass killings in the name of the Lord, but you can also have secular mass murders as well, right? So I think whether you're good or evil can be disconnected from religion, but I do think that religion is a way that encourages people to be thoughtful about their morals, even if at times it can provide a kind of shield for people who are immoral in the name of God.
This idea of not demonizing the other. A lot of our political disagreements are based on morality and different points of view about what is morality, what constitutes morality. And you say that to increase tolerance and civility, we need to understand the nature of the moral judgment and the processes that move us toward conflict over those judgments. You say the key point to recognize is that these feelings on both sides are sincere. Does that, if you embrace that idea that the other person, you may not agree, but they're being sincere about their beliefs, does that diffuse things? Does it lead to empathy? Does it lead to helping you dial back the heat?
Yes, I mean, we found it in our studies, and I found it in my personal experience, right? When you have a conversation with someone and you ask them about their personal experiences and beliefs of why they believe what they believe, right? They will tell you these kind of deep feelings of threat, the harms that they see. And they're not inventing it. And when you appreciate that someone's voting for a policy because it thinks it will help them keep their job, it will help them pay for the medical care for their children, it will keep the borders safe, right? When you understand that, even if you disagree, you say, well, that's not actually going to keep our borders safe. Sure. But what's driving their opinion is this genuine concern about harm. And once you recognize that, you can have a more reasonable conversation with them.
I want to get back to facts because facts matter, but maybe not. At least according to you. You say that facts are largely useless in this moral divide that we're facing, and you point to storytelling, a technique that humans have used for thousands of years to understand different points of view. I mean, that's what the Bible is about, allegories. This seems to explain the political moment. Donald Trump plays extremely loose with the facts, and I'm being kind here, but his followers don't care. They have bought into the story that has been woven around Donald Trump as a kind of latter-day Messiah who's going to fix all of our problems, and only he can fix them. The left is positively apoplectic about this approach. All the lies and the dis and the misinformation that he trades in and wants to counter, they want to counter it with facts. And facts aren't resonating with people. What is the lesson to be learned here?
It's hard to understand facts and statistics. Like, there's a baseline when I teach students statistics, right? It takes an entire semester to kind of even get them to think in terms of this, and it's hard, right? We fudge, as we know from our conversation before the break, we kind of fudge our math to support our beliefs. And so if you're trying to have a conversation with another person who you want to talk to, right? A coworker, a family member, don't start by throwing facts at each other, even if facts do matter, right? We can say the facts matter in the world. But that initial conversation where you want to build respect, where you want to build some rapport, start with stories, right? Tell them something personal about you and why you believe a certain issue. And then ask them to share their perspective too, personally, because the facts we have today are really just regurgitating talking points from cable news and social media, right? I think if you make conversations personal and about your own story, it provides the first step to having more civil conversations.
Is that where the Democrats have gone wrong? They counter the lack of facts with the fact check thesaurus of facts that they throw out there, and they don't combine it with some sort of personal story or some sort of story that points to the result of the policy that they're railing against. Is that the problem here? We all
I
should
do
stop
think,
being storytellers.
well, I think every journalist, right, knows that you open with stories, right? Every article, every New Yorker article, New York Times, right? There's like, here's a, it was a wet Wednesday night and someone was walking through the rain thinking, right? You start the story because that resonates with us. It has a truth. You mentioned the Bible, right? The Bible is the world's best-selling book and it has been for a long time because those stories resonate with people. So I think you can use facts, but I don't think you want to lead with the facts. You want to get a captivating story and then tie it to the facts. I do think that makes for a more compelling kind of persuasion campaign.
But does it work? Because you go back to that math problem that you talked about. The numbers are the numbers. Either concealed carry leads to a safer world or it does not. And if you do the math, it will tell you one thing, and that is the answer. But if you're a Republican, you see it completely differently than you would as a Democrat. That's a story. If stories aren't based in absolute fact, if they are allegorical, or they could be interpreted in several different ways, have we advanced the narrative? Have we advanced our political divide?
I mean, if you think about people's personal opinions, and I think you think about the kind of what the stories are and the feelings that they're grounding it in, I'm not sure it's always so cut and dry. So think about guns, right? Statistically speaking, you know, as a Canadian coming from a country where there's no handguns, no concealed carry, right? There's fewer gun deaths for sure. But also there are real experiences of folks in America who have used guns to defend themselves from a home invader, right? Guns are in our constitution. Someone comes into your house with a gun. You use a gun to defend yourself. That's a story of protection, right? And there are hundreds of thousands of people who have done that, protected themselves. So in some sense, I do think there's a powerful weight to stories. And I do think that they're a legitimate source of evidence for people and their moral opinions, right? And so I think the question of what facts are most relevant to a particular debate, especially your personal life, I think are more up for grabs than we often think, right? Yeah.
No, I wasn't going to bring this up because when you talk about Hitler, the conversation gets sidetracked. But I'm going to bring it up because I'm not sure that I understand your point of view on this. One of the things that you talk about is the need for understanding, which we've been talking about. If you understand the other side, perhaps we can find some middle ground. And when you understand a person, you understand the whole person. You understand how they got to where they are today. And you have this chapter titled Blame, Moral Typecasting, in which you start out by talking about Hitler. And I bring this up because Hitler and the Nazis are re-entering the zeitgeist at the moment. You say that no one ever thinks of Hitler's inner pain or the fact that he was abused as a child. And then you tell the story of a 14-year-old boy in Texas who was also brutally abused as a child, ended up killing his father, his stepmother, and his stepsister because of that abuse. And you say that when we look at him, our moral mind treats him differently than Hitler. Rather than insensitive villain, he is seen as a suffering victim. We empathize. But Hitler was a psychopath who killed millions of people and who was in the who controlled the lives of millions of other people who could do nothing about his actions. So why is this story important? Now help me to understand why they're equivalent. Are they equivalent? An understanding of Hitler does what for us?
They're not equivalent, right? And that's what the gist of the chapter is about. And I also think it's worth mentioning the sentence directly after that first sentence, right? Which is, no one thinks of Hitler's inner pain, and fair enough, he was a monster who did monstrous things, right? So let's make sure that's clear for listeners. But I do think that it hits on this way our mind works. All right, these are extreme examples, right? The most evil man the world has ever known and an orphan who is abused. And the way our mind works is that we typecast, in a moral sense, people into either villain roles like Hitler or victim roles like Cody, this orphan. And I think the thrust of the chapter is that we project these roles onto people in our lives who are not as evil as Hitler or who is not as victimized as an orphan, right? We simplify, you know, your mother-in-law or your cousin or your coworker, you immediately, like, they're like Hitler, right? Or they're totally blameless. They're like an abused orphan. And so it's the way our mind simplifies the moral world too much into black and white. When I think, if you think of your coworker or your family members, someone who disagrees with you on an issue, right? It's more like shades of gray. And I end this the chapter with the kind of story of a Holocaust survivor and amazing writer named Primo Levi, who really talks about the importance of, you know, making sense of the complexity of the moral world, even in terrible places like these camps.
So the gist of all this is to have conversations with people, to listen to them, to try to understand where they're coming from. And then you also say to try to validate these opposing points of view. I wish I had time to ask you how you do that and maintain your own personal sanity and not descend into even deeper rage, but we don't have time. Kurt Gray's book is called Outraged: Why We Fight About Morality and Politics and How to Find Common Ground. He's at UNC Chapel Hill on his way to the Ohio State University. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.